Hey everyone, welcome to episode 26 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. If this is your first time listening, thanks for tuning in and welcome. The Historic Performance Podcast is published every Tuesday and Thursday, and notes from today's show can be found at www.historicperformance.net/podcast. The best way to keep up to date with the podcast is to follow me via Twitter at Historic Perform. There I publish all of the latest episodes and give you the opportunity to ask questions and provide recommendations for future guests. Before getting to the information about today's episode, I actually want to talk about a nonprofit organization which is very dear to my heart. Many of you who follow Historic Performance outside of the podcast will know that I'm extremely passionate about soccer, but also I am very passionate about the sport of powerlifting. My good friend John Downing established a nonprofit organization called Lift for Life last year, and I want to hand it over to him right now so he can explain a little bit about the organization and what its mission is.
Hey guys, John Downing here at the nonprofit organization called Lift for Life. Lift for Life is a nonprofit all about the sport of powerlifting. Powerlifting has and always will be a community. Because of the fellowship within the lifting community, the sport is thriving more than ever before. With that in mind, Lift for Life ultimately has one goal: building a sustainable community of powerlifters in countries that do not yet have the sport. Lift for Life has a mission behind that goal. That is raising funds for nutritional and strength training resources and equipment in low-income and at-risk communities around the world. To that end, we want to create a community of powerlifters, again, in countries that do not have it. We believe the sport thrives upon this idea of community, and that's something we can implement in other countries. I really appreciate James Darley and Historic Performance for giving us this opportunity to share with you about Lift for Life. If you have more questions about the organization and if you'd like to donate to the cause, please see the links below that James is going to provide for you so you can check out our website, see where you can donate. And if you have more questions, please send them my way with the email included below.
I would highly recommend that you check out the Lift for Life website. Even if you're not interested in donating, he has a Facebook page where he talks about the progress that is being made in Zimbabwe in terms of establishing their first powerlifting facility. It's a pretty interesting read, and you can also go ahead and like the Facebook page and just spread the word. The more people that know about it, the more likely there is for Lift for Life to bring about the success needed in order to bring the sport of powerlifting into these low-income communities. So any help would be greatly appreciated. To talk to a little bit about today's episode, I'm actually chatting with Rich Hesketh, who's up in Canada. Rich is really a wealth of information when it comes to hockey. He was with the Calgary Flames for 19 years. And in this episode, we talk about a variety of topics. You'll notice that I'm not an expert when it comes to hockey, not even close. But we talk about some of the dangers of early specialization, why he believes the play is important for young hockey players, his thoughts about what is fundamental to have in a hockey program, and finally, just recommendations that he has for young strength and conditioning coaches that he learned throughout his 19-year career. So it's a pretty good episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Let's get it started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, it's going to be a little bit of a curveball. It's going to be a first for the Historic Performance Podcast. I was introduced to Rich Hesketh from Nathan Bullock. Nathan was previously on the podcast. He had started at Manchester City and then came over to Canada. So that's how he ended up meeting Rich. Rich has a really lengthy history in strength and conditioning. He was in with Canadian track and field, and then he was with the Calgary Flames, I believe, for 19 years, if I'm correct.
That's correct. Yeah.
So Rich, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Rich, I'm super excited for this. I'm going to be perfectly honest. I don't know a lot about hockey, but I'm sure the listeners and I are going to learn a lot today. And it's always great to learn about different sports.
Well, that's, I hope I get a chance to, and I hope people out there really get a listen to it with an open mind and understand that a lot of what has gone on in the hockey world is also through experimentation and making mistakes, but also some pretty pure science to it. So we'll try and combine a little bit of everything today.
Sounds great. So Rich, can you start us off by giving a little bit about your background and how you ended up in hockey?
Sure thing. You know, I was a track and field athlete through most of high school and university, although I did do multiple sports. When it came to be track season, I was a track athlete. When it was basketball season, I played basketball. But getting into university, I had to make a decision as to what sport I was going to dedicate myself to. So I decided to go into track and field, and from a multi-sport mindset, I went into the decathlon. Whether that was the brightest thing in the world, I don't know, but I had some success with it. Several national teams and you know, meeting great people and doing a little bit of travel along the way being an athlete. And then to give back to the sport, around the mid-90s, I started coaching track and field, was mentored by a longtime Athletics Canada head coach, Les Gramantic, who's right here in Calgary, who is my coach for the last 12 or 13 years of my career. So that really spurred me on. But you know what? I had some great mentors along the way, right from my high school track coaches, my high school football coaches and basketball coach. And then my very first, I guess, full-term track and field coach at McMaster University, where I went to school. And that spurred me on to have more of a multi-sport, multi-discipline mindset when it came to training. And when I finished my degree way back in 1987, there was a quick realization that there wasn't a lot of information out there from the strength and conditioning world. And I took it upon myself. And, you know, honestly, remember having a conversation with my coach, Les, and we said, how the heck can we get professional sports to get a clear understanding of what it means to train, not just to play the game and not necessarily go golfing in the off season and or do nothing in the off season and then come back in shape, but to make it essentially a 12-month a year discipline to training the way amateur athletes have always done it in track and field and in other sports. And strangely enough, through my trying to educate myself on my own, again, there wasn't a lot out there. You could certainly take courses, and it was part of the degree content that I took. But from the strength and conditioning side of things, most of what I learned was either self-inflicted or inflicted upon me by the coaches who worked with me. So the lab was me, and the lab was the coaches that I worked with. So it was a really interesting path for me. So that when I did eventually, my very first hire was Theron Fleury. In 1992, he interviewed me for a strength and conditioning position to be his own personal strength and conditioning coach. And we started training, embarking on that for a couple of summers of training. He had some great years, made some good results. And through that association in hockey, and also through a physiotherapist who got into the hockey world in 1995, I was recommended to be hired by the Calgary Flames Hockey Club as their strength and conditioning coach, which, you know, honestly, it scratched my head. I couldn't understand how a guy who's been involved in a running, jumping, and throwing sport, and for the most part, you know, football, basketball, track and field is all high impact ground contact sports, and all of a sudden I was going to be involved in a gliding sport. I played hockey as a kid. I was a hockey fan, and still am. I have a clear understanding of the game itself, but as far as the game itself, I had already made a decision in my school sports. There was no hockey, so I was more track and field based for sure. So I kind of scratched my head and I was going, well, how the heck did I get myself into this? But, you know, understanding the systems of training, both from speed, power, strength, conditioning, dynamic ability, mobility, I applied a lot of the knowledge that I had received through my other coaches and through the application of training as a decathlete, and all those systems are applied as a decathlete. The exercise prescription is different, but the physiology and the science is the same. So that's how I initiated how I would program for hockey. So as I've learned more about joint angles and force production and gliding over impact, it certainly has changed what my approach is. And quite honestly, some of the mistakes that I made with Theo when he was training with me, I've rectified, and every day I'm trying to get better as a strength coach. So it's something that I'll never stop learning, and I'm always going to try and get better at.
Yeah, Rich, and I really think that happens a lot when, as you are spend more time in a specific career, your coaching philosophy evolves. So you mentioned how some of the things that you did early on, you ended up changing throughout your 19-year career with the Calgary Flames. So I think to set an overview for this podcast, maybe it would be nice to talk about what your coaching philosophy is and how it evolved throughout the years.
Well, that's a great question. Philosophically, I take a multi-sport approach, multi-directional, as well as trying to introduce athletes to using their body as the tool for their game. So that doesn't just apply to what you're doing in the weight room. It doesn't just apply to what you're doing on the track or on the turf. It certainly applies to being able to manage a holistic approach toward your training. So I always will fall back on the fundamentals of movement. Again, coming from the track and field background, running, jumping, and throwing mechanics, although for the most part, hip positions and foot positions are slightly different for skating. I will always go back to those dynamic components of running drills, jumping drills, obviously alignment of the hip, knee, and feet together, finding your foot underneath you for being able to generate as much force as possible. But even with throwing mechanics, if you think of what I would call ground connection, when you are throwing, so how much force you can generate from your feet to whatever implement you're throwing, or from the hockey side, shooting a puck. For the most part, again, that whole adage of you can't shoot a cannon out of a canoe, you certainly have to have your feet firmly planted and have as much force development from the ground up in order to generate those kinds of forces. So from that end, I will always go back to, I use as simple technique as walking over hurdles. Although hockey players will never be hurdlers, and nor do I want them to be, we certainly use walking over hurdles with sticks and bands and medicine balls and weights over their heads to create instabilities in their center of gravity, but still moving through hip mobility movement so that there's a full range of motion and a full range of athleticism about it. So yes, you have to be specific in your movements, but I'm always one to go back to, let's go back to the basics. Let's really just step back and take for a second, what does it mean to become a better athlete? And as you become a better athlete, in turn, you become better for your sport. I have never once said to any professional hockey player that I'm going to make them more skilled in hockey. I would be foolish to think that's possible. They have been years at their sport and honing in their skills. But at the end of the day, I'm going to make them a better athlete so they become better to play hockey. And one of the areas that I've tried to model myself after from that side is you can take an example of what Sweden is doing. Sweden is a powerhouse at this point in hockey, but if you look at the athletes that are coming out of Sweden, they are phenomenal athletes. And a lot of them start what we would call late in hockey. In the North American system, if you're not in the system by the time you're 6 or 7 years old, people think you've started late. And a lot of those guys have not gotten into hockey until later in life, but they've honed their skills of becoming a better athlete. And philosophically, I am going to go that route, multi-sport, play, can enjoy what you're doing, play training when you're young, and get a chance to experience many different movement patterns so that at the end of the day, when it gets called on, you can use it for your sport itself.
Do you feel that's an issue in hockey, especially here in North America, that perhaps we're pushing our kids to specialize too early and then leading to a host of other issues that comes with that early specialization?
I do. There's a distinct, and I think we're seeing more research going into that the early specialization of something that honestly is quite unnatural as skating on hockey skates, can cause a lot of the hip, groin, abdominal, that complex issue in our younger athletes. And we're seeing athletes at a younger age having what I would call old man syndromes, where bad hips, bad groins, bad abdominals, sport hernias. And really that's coming from the lack of, or I guess the overuse injuries, the overdoing one specific movement without doing a multitude of ranges, as well as a multitude of planes of motion.
When you're talking about your coaching philosophy, you talked about going back to the fundamentals.
Yes.
When you're creating a program for a hockey player, a professional hockey player, and I know it's going to vary if it's the off season, the in season.
Yeah.
What are some essential factors that you believe needs to be within a program, because hockey's a gliding sport versus, you know, your traditional running sports?
Right. Well, and this is one of the areas we can focus on. When you talk about the specific strengthening or the specific movement patterns, there are certain drills you can do to mimic the movement of skating, and that can be done on a track or on the grass, in a crouch position. If you remember the American speed skater Eric Heiden, he developed some low hip position movement patterns that mimic the skating, and he would get into those positions and basically stride up hills and do a lot of his strength training in those kinds of positions, specific to skating, but specific to the hip position and quad position that he needed to be in to become a great speed skater. We can implement a lot of those similar motions and a lot of those similar movement patterns for hockey skating as well. Now, a speed skater doesn't have to run into the boards. So from the hockey sense, we have to be cognizant of the fact that players will be flying around the ice at about 50 kilometers an hour, or, you know, 30 miles an hour, and getting hit and running into the boards. So mass through shoulders, chest, back in that complex of the upper body is necessary for injury prevention. Not just for shooting, not just for your shot and body checking, but also for running into the boards, so that you're staying on top of that side of it. So, from the fundamental side, again, we know that, probably one of the best ways to get fast as a skater, if you're not skating, is to train more like a sprinter. So, in the elements early on in use for an off-season training program, any speed development or acceleration development will be done in a very linear fashion. So run in a straight line, don't have to change direction, don't have to stop. You're training far more like a linear sprinter to start off with, just to learn the mechanics of where your feet are in relation to your hip and your center of gravity. Then once you've established those positions, you can progress into some soft direction change. So softer corners where you're going out and back in a softer conditioning fashion. So if we're talking about it in speed development, it would be softer direction change or 45 degree angle turns. If you're talking about it from a conditioning side, you can go out and back in 20 yards or 20 meters in soft corners. So start getting used to the direction change before you start getting into the next phase of stops and starts, where you would get into, if it's a shuttle run, having a ball or two balls set out at a 10 meter or a 10 yard marker, start, grab the ball, bring it back, go out and get another one and come back, so that you're getting the stops and starts that eccentric load of having to stop and go again as a progression to getting prepared for the stops and starts that you're going to be doing in hockey as well. So from the gliding side, again, those hip positions that you would use as Eric Heiden would, or any, if you see any speed skating movement patterns, that's a very interesting way to model your training after that, is to, you know, if anyone gets an opportunity to go to a speed skating, or even go online and watch some of the speed skating training videos, it's a really interesting way of achieving the proper hip and joint angles that you need to be explosive for skating. And it's very similar to hockey. The only difference is the length of the blade and the contact time that blade is on the ice. So in many respects, there's a faster twitch muscle fiber that is necessary as a hockey player than as a speed skater, but they're still needed to be in that hip position.
You mentioned the off season. How long is the off season in hockey, usually pro hockey?
Well, you know, that's always a conundrum you get into, depending on how well you do in the season. So from the professional side, if you do not make the playoffs, and if there are, you know, if you're the unfortunate group that didn't make it, your season is done in early April or mid-April. So you have essentially from the middle of April to the beginning of middle, I guess, of September for preparation. So you're going to go through an active recovery, a rest period of about anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks, which we would call active rest, where you're not doing nothing. You're preferably not sitting on the couch watching TV all day, but you're getting out and doing other things, playing tennis, going out for bike rides, enjoying life, essentially go for a run with your dog, those kinds of things. Live life as a normal human being. But then essentially from about mid-May or June, you've got close to an 18-week training cycle that you can go through, so you can address those issues of reacquisition of aerobic fitness, maximum strength improvements, speed and power development, and specific training on top of that. So if you're, again, unfortunate that you finish your season early, obviously you have a longer preparation time. If you are one of the, fortunate people who go all the way and win a championship or get deep into the playoffs, then you're looking obviously at a much shorter. If we know that now, the first or second week of June, they're playing the Stanley Cup final. Usually the final game is around that time. So, you know, now you've got about 8 weeks in order to prepare, which is for the most part recovery. So it is very dynamic depending on how you are doing in the season. So the preparation time that you need obviously gets shorter the more successful you are, which lends itself to, and I don't know if you've heard it or if your listeners have heard it, the Stanley Cup hangover, where you know, and that has a lot to do with the fact that they're just, you know, honestly, there isn't enough time to recover from that grind, both the wear and tear on the body of that schedule, but also there's just not enough time to do the correct type of preparation and fitness acquisition that's going to carry you through to another season. So I think we're seeing it's quite rare to have people repeat or even to get to the final a second time. Those who have obviously have done a really good job of their regeneration and managing their in-season load as well. And again, that's another dynamic. That's a whole new kettle of fish when you start talking about what happens in season. And certainly we can touch on that as well.
That's actually what I was about to transition to. Since we talked about the off-season, I want to talk about the in-season. Yeah. Because you have tons of games, pretty grueling schedule. Want to know, on a typical week, how often are these players even able to do any type of strength work in the gym? And then B, how do you monitor fatigue and player readiness and make sure that players are recovering as best as they can?
Yeah, Well, that is a loaded question. I'll tell you that, because the clear understanding, and like you said, and with I mean, even with soccer, the number of games that you play are monumental. In hockey, a regular season is 82 games. Sometimes you're playing three times in a week. Sometimes you're playing five times in a week. So that element of recovery and regeneration is critical. So within the construct, and I can only speak for what has been done in Calgary and sort of the protocols that we've tried to set up. One of the number one things we made a point of focusing on was nutrition. So both post-game and post-practice recovery shakes, call them power shakes, with different ratios of protein and carbohydrate to them, but also having meals available immediately after practices and games to the players. So they're getting an immediate regeneration. They're getting their nutrition as quickly as they can after they've cooled down, or for some of them have done a workout right after a game. Now, I don't think you can ever say there's a typical week in the NHL, because again, it's such a dynamic environment, just because of the changes. The number of minutes a player plays will vary from game to game, depending on what the coach sees and how he wants to push that athlete. Or how little a player plays can also play a role as to how much or how little they're going to be doing. So my general rule of thumb while I was working in the NHL was that post-game was probably one of the best times to get a workout in. For those who played really big minutes, if they were fit enough and had the experience and understood their bodies well enough, some of those guys would do full weight workouts right after a game. I found that a lot of the younger players who don't have the same kind of training history, and to be quite frank, one of the only ways to train for an 82 game schedule is to play an 82 game schedule. So those who don't have those years of training history under their belt, some of them just couldn't manage extra loading after a game. So what would happen is after a game, we get a stat sheet that tells us how many minutes each player played. And I would divide them into players who've played from between 0 and 10 minutes. And I would have pretty much a full workout set out for them. So they would do a full strength training session of anywhere from 4 or 5 exercises that they would do, both Olympic lifts as well as supplemental lifts for general conditioning on that side. But they would also do a level of conditioning on a bike to up their aerobic capacity as well. Those guys who played the big minutes and the guys who played the small minutes are all on the same page physiologically. So then I would divide the next group into a group of players who played from 10 to 15 minutes, and they would do maybe a set or two less in the weight room, or maybe cut it down to 2 or 3 exercises in the weight room. Again, less of volume of intervals on the bike. Again, just to bump up their physiology, so they're again on the same page as the guys who play the big minutes. And then the players who went 15 to 20 minutes on the ice would do a little bit of a cool down, some work around recovery, 10 or 15 minute bike ride or treadmill, where they would just try and get themselves back to a reasonable resting state, and then do some core stabilization work, or even some shoulder stabilizing work, where they'll address prehab, rehab kind of activities to make sure that things are stable and strong around their support joints. And then for the guys who play the big minutes, the 20 minute plus players, which is quite a load for those guys, there was the odd player who could handle a little bit of a weight workout, but that was on a game by game basis. We'd have almost have to have a meeting individually with each guy, and he was, well, I'm feeling good. Do you think I should get a little lift in? And for the most part, those guys who are fit enough to handle it will benefit from it. So then again, those other guys who couldn't handle the additional load, they would just do a cool down, a stretch, and then get something to eat right away. So from at the end of the day, the objective for me was to make sure that every player that walked out of the weight room after a game was in the same physiological state, so that whether they had a day off the next day or whether they were on the ice and doing a great skating session or practice session, they were all on the same page physiologically, so that no one was losing or gaining fitness one way or the other.
So I have two follow-up questions. Question one, in terms of your goalies, your hockey and hockey, would they be doing the same programs as those who are actually, I don't know what the right term is, I guess on the ice?
The skaters. Yeah, the skaters. No, you know what? You're right. That's an excellent question, because goaltenders are not the same. The general sense is that goalies are a little bit weird, but I've played goal, so I don't think they're that weird. but at the end of the day, their systems are different. They're the only ones who get to play the whole game. They get to play the full 60 minutes. So they're the tax. What's taxed on them, again, is a little more aerobic based. Although they're a reactive position, someone who is a very good goalie, you're not going to see them moving around a lot. And from the outside looking in, it really doesn't look like they're doing very much. But if you ever put on the gear and get up and down a whole bunch of times during a game, you get tired, and it's just a different kind of tired. So from that end, I would tend to send the goalies off to do a pretty pedestrian cool down, but then spend a whole lot of time on their flexibility and really making sure they're staying on top of that side of it, because that's an element that for them, without it, they're going to be lost. So I think that's an excellent point. One of the things that was really interesting for me is I had never played goal on the ice. Street hockey, sure. I'd play goalie all the time. My big brother would put me in the net and fire pucks at my head. So I was the target. But there was a point in my career, it was probably around 1998 or 99. The team had gone on the road. I was back with a group of five or six injured guys. And they were all not so injured that they couldn't get on the ice, but they were too injured to play the game. And at that point, I was thinking, well, what am I going to do with you? Take you out and run drills? I mean, that would be that would be crazy. So I thought, well, you know what? I'll find some goalie gear and I'll throw it on and I'll play goal, and you guys can, you know, play 3-on-3 or get your general, your specific conditioning by playing a little bit, and then you'll have someone to shoot pucks at. And just by getting myself into that and I took it upon myself to learn more about the position, ask some questions. I did get some help with some coaching, from the goalie coaches that were part of the team. And it completely changed my approach to how to work with goaltenders. It's a very specific position. Again, from the outside, it doesn't really look like you're doing much, because you're staying in a 6-foot space, essentially. You're staying in your crease. Yeah, you can come out of your crease and move the puck or stop the puck and help out your defenseman. But for the most part, you're in a pretty tight confines of where you can go and where you are going as far as your space of competition is. So from that end, it changed my approach. I used to think that strength was far more important than I realized it is, where now I would tend more toward less strength and more velocity of movement. So a lot more use of velocity meters and moving with speed, but also with an incredible amount of aerobic conditioning again, because they're the ones who can play 60 minutes and they're going to be demanded of it. And in some cases, 65 minutes if they go to overtime.
So my second follow-up question, and it involved actually the communication in terms of you as a strength and conditioning staff and then your coaching staff. So the people are actually in with them day in and day out in terms of their, I guess, skill drills and their general practice. How much communication would be going on? I know sometimes in soccer, you have a sports scientist or fitness coach sometimes telling the coach, you know, how hard they should be going in terms of their practice. Was that a role that you're fulfilling at Calgary Flames, or was it not really that same dynamic?
Well, the interesting thing is it varies from coach to coach in hockey. There's a broad spectrum of levels of understanding of science of training for NHL coaches. Not all of them are as advanced, if I can say that. There are some who are still in the world of old school, you know, the harder you work, the better you're going to get kind of mentality. And in some cases, training is a method of discipline, which from my world makes absolutely no sense, but from their world makes all the sense in the world. So I've been on both sides of the fence. I've had coaches who have asked me for input as to when, where, and how they should apply certain elements of training. So when should we focus on speed? When should we focus on aerobic capacity? When we should work on some lactate training? And I've also had some who all my role was just to support what they were doing. And in many cases, it's putting out fires where a coach has decided that, you know, you guys are no good, so I'm just going to skate the heck out of you. And we'll call it a bag skate is what they're called. And, you know, if you throw up, that's great. And, you know, so from that end, medical support staff and strength and conditioning staff have to pick up the pieces at the end in many cases. So that's where that recovery and regeneration side becomes paramount, because at the end of the day, an 82-game schedule is more of a war of attrition than it is high performance in reality. There's nothing about a professional 82-game schedule that has anything to do with the athlete. It has everything to do with sport entertainment and making money on the tickets that are being sold. It's a harsh reality, but it's a decision that as a hockey player or as a professional athlete, you have to be aware of that side of it and do the best you can to work within those constructs and recover as well as you can. I've often said when I entered into the National Hockey League as someone who I would say comes from a little more pure periodized sport, because in track and field you can pick a date and say I have to be ready for this date, and that's the Olympic Games, and that's when I'm going to have to be at my peak performance. You can't do that 82 games in 210 days. It's not possible. When I came into the sport, I had all these thoughts about how we could periodize around training and when and what kind of phases we're going to have, and you know, when do we implement strength, when do we implement speed within a season. And it quickly became apparent to me that I was barking up the wrong tree. You have to take those theories and methodologies and put them on the shelf and become a really good listener to the athletes as they walk through the door. Because on any given day, you're going to come across people with, you're going to have 23 different guys with 23 different answers to one question about how they're feeling. So we become a bit of a sounding board, but you also have to come up with a pretty, pretty good listening ear so that you can have an understanding. Some of the languages that I would listen for, personally, when guys came through, I'd ask, how do your legs feel? And someone would say, well, my legs feel heavy, or they feel I have no jump, or, you know, even I feel good, or, you know, I feel really sharp. And based on those, that little bit of feedback, it gave me a pretty clear understanding of where the athlete was in their training and recovery. Because for the most part, someone saying that their legs are heavy, there's a good chance that they've had a fairly high lactate day the day before. And maybe it might be best to do, you know, a bit of a flush, you know, on the treadmill or on the bike, and just kind of aerobically help flush out the legs and just kind of get that heaviness out. If someone says, I have no jump, there's a good chance that their nervous system is a little bit fried, or they need a shot of something explosive or something challenging to get a little shot of testosterone into their system by either doing a strong lift or a bit of a leg circuit just to wake things up. Or if someone says they feel great, is that a good opportunity to get a pretty solid training session in, or do a little bit extra after practice or even before practice before they get out there? So you certainly have to become a listener. You have to understand language, definitely, but understand what someone is saying to you and be able to adapt your ideas to what they're saying to you as an athlete. And it was interesting. It wasn't that long ago. It was a week and a half ago, I believe. I went to a seminar of an exercise physiologist, and he was saying just that. You can have all the science in the world, but the best way to have a clear understanding if something is working within your program is to listen to what the athletes are saying and get the feedback from them.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. The last thing I want to touch upon is energy system development for hockey. So in terms of hockey, when you're talking about the off season and improving aerobic capacity, what exactly are you trying, when the players first come back during the preseason, you know, what type of fitness assessments are you doing? And then B, how do you use those fitness assessments to figure out what energy systems you want to work on?
Right. And again, depending on what team you're with, they all have their own testing protocols, and that's based around the philosophy of the sports science team that you have or the strength and conditioning coach who's in charge. Again, I was really fortunate to have, and in the beginning it was the University of Calgary Human Performance Lab as a resource. We developed a testing protocol in the preseason. It would be called training camp. So for training camp, we developed a system that covered all systems. So we had aerobic capacity, doing submaximal VO2s. We learned a little bit about their flexibility, explosive power, their speed strength, and their aerobic power by doing a 2.5 minute hard bike ride and getting values in watts per kilo. Now, this is very lab based. We could repeat it anytime we wanted. And we had some excellent data over the last 20 years of those who came into camp with a really balanced approach to their training also showed up in the balance of their performance in all areas. So if there was an area where I could stress for anyone who's looking at parameters for testing, you need to apply all systems. So you need to look at speed. You need to look at power. You need to look at strength, aerobic capacity, ability to tolerate lactic. So anything to involve the Wingate style of testing on a bike or sprinting for that matter. And have a really balanced approach to the protocol that you're looking at. If you can incorporate all of those systems into the training, you're going to have a much more balanced athlete. And indeed, those athletes who had the most success during the year were the ones who had the most balance in their training and the most balance in all systems. There wasn't necessarily massive dips in different systems. So for example, if you had an athlete who wasn't explosive enough, that would be an area that you knew you would have to target. So in all those areas, we had parameters around If an athlete was deficient aerobically, or if an athlete was deficient anaerobically, or if an athlete was deficient in strength, then we could categorize them into an area of training both during the year, but for the most part in focus in the off season, when you could actually use periodization and methodology to help that athlete become better so that they're better for the next season. So, those protocols are critical to be able to fall back as a resource throughout the year. And then once the off season comes, that's when you can really focus in. And again, that was the fun time for me, was off season, because I could apply all the science and methodologies around training in order for the athletes to become in peak, coming back into peak condition for training camp.
Yeah, I agree. The fun part for me is also the off season with soccer players, because it's very similar to what you're mentioning here. Sorry, the way I like to finish every single podcast, especially because there's a lot of young strength coaches listening to this podcast, both in Europe and in North America, for the guests to provide them with some recommendations that really help them out throughout their career, things that you wish you knew when you're starting out, that help you become successful. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting when you ask that, because I get that question quite a bit, and it always makes me think. It's extremely important for anyone who's getting into strength conditioning, or even if they have been in it and feel like they either like to go a different direction or work on a different sport. But have your philosophies of training well set. So if you know what your strengths are, understand what those strengths are, and work within those within those strengths. So if for example, my ability to program around all the different systems and having a clear understanding of how to apply those within the different cycles of training is what's helped me as far as my strengths, but also my eye for the fundamentals of training. So if someone is more from the prehab, rehab, functional movement strengths, go with that. Don't try and be everything to everybody. Be true to yourself, be true to what you are strong at. And be aware too that if your strength is about velocity training, or if your strength is in strength training and the techniques around Olympic lifting, stick with that side of it and keep your strengths, and then read and learn from other people as much as you can. Quite honestly, I've been to seminars, I've done my degrees, I've done everything from that end of it, but I've never learned more than going out for a beer with a coach and just sitting and listening to someone who's got more experience than I do. And in many ways, that helps you with any mistakes that you're going to make, or keeps you from making mistakes, because they've already made them. Learn from those mistakes and value what they've already done, as don't try and reinvent the wheel. Honestly, there's not a lot out there that's really all that new. I think we're seeing obviously the trend toward using velocity meters as a methodology of training, which I'm a strong believer of as well. But when it comes right down to the physiology and the science of training, there's really not all that much new out there. I think we just have to look and be solid in our movement patterning and make sure that athletes are prepared at the best of our ability to generate as much force as they can through the ground into whatever sport that they're in. So as an athlete becomes a better athlete, they become better for their sport. So I hope that wasn't too convoluted. I just kind of went off on a tangent there, but I think that's if you can be strong in those philosophies that you have, then go with them and enjoy it, because it's a ride. Don't be afraid to experiment a little bit. Use the weight room as your lab. Use the track or the field that you're on as a bit of an experimentation. Take those things that have worked and hang on to them, and those things that don't work, just throw them out, and take that as, well, I learned from that experience, and go on from there.
No, it wasn't a tangent at all, and I was actually smiling as you were saying this stuff, because it sounded very similar to the advice that Dr. Brian Mann, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, gave. And he basically said that he recommended that people find their niche, yes, and then become as good as possible in terms of their niche, where they become so invaluable to whatever organization they are that they basically can't get rid of them.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I would agree with that for sure. I mean, that's sound advice as well. And, you know, I applaud him for his foresight in that too.
So Rich, if anyone has any questions or comments, what's the best way that they can reach out to you?
Best route to go from, for me is my email address is rjhesketh@shaw.ca. I'm also at Twitter @RichHesketh. I just got on Instagram, but that's mostly going to be pictures of training and whatnot. So I'll have to get to work on, developing my following with that. So, those are probably the best ways to get a hold of me.
Perfect. And I'm going to be publishing that on my website when this podcast is published in the next couple of weeks. So that way they can easily access it. Rich, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really indebted to Nathan Bullock for putting me in contact with you. And this was super informative for me. I mean, I'm sure at some points I sounded a little naive, probably not using the right terminology, but it was a learning experience for me too.
No, I'm happy to help out anywhere as far as that goes. And, you know, if it brings a little more information out there, I'm happy to do it. And I certainly appreciate that you value that information enough to put it on your podcast, because you've got some very interesting speakers on.
Rich, I thank you very much, and have a good evening.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys, for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, please make sure to leave a review and rating on iTunes. It really helps others discover the show, and I'll see you guys next time.